This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Until very recently, Dmitry Bykov was a big presence on the Russian literary scene. He's a novelist, a poet, a biographer, and a critic. He's also one of the most outspoken and brilliant critics of Russian life and politics. He was a frequent presence on Echo of Moscow, the liberal radio station that was finally shut down after the invasion of Ukraine. And as a commentator, he pronounced scathing judgments, truly scathing, on the nature and character of Vladimir Putin and the increasingly authoritarian regime he was building. And that never endeared him to those in power. In recent years, Bykov has been teaching on and off in the United States at Cornell University, but because of his forthright opposition to the war in Ukraine, it's not at all clear that he'll ever return home. You were just in Ukraine. Tell me about the circumstances of the trip and what you saw.
You can only feel it. You know, that's really a strange feeling of people who live after death. They have decided for them on the 23rd of February that they are dead, that everything is lost. And now they're quite free. You know, that's like Japanese school of samurai. Imagine that you are dead and then act. You are living after death. Everything is finished. So feel yourself free and decisive. They are free and decisive. It's a kind of carnival after death. It's very merry and very horrifying. The people who really decided to die for their country because they have no exit, they really feel the firm wall behind them.
There's no exit.
Yeah, no exit and no place to run. Most of men before 60 just are forbidden to leave the country. And by the way, there were so long lines to get arms to join the so-called territorial defense. You never could imagine such an active population, especially to compare them with Russian population, which prefers to spend its time in restaurants as if nothing happened. So all Ukraine is mobilized, and all Ukraine is a kind of plasma which is ready for transformation in something unpredictable and maybe unimaginable.
Tell me how you received the news that Russia, under Putin, was invading Ukraine. Did it take you by surprise, or was this just an extension of what began in 2014?
Well, you know, there is a really complicated problem because I was waiting for the war for recent 20 years. I was predicting it in most of my books. And for example, one of my books is just called The Chronicle of the Near East War. I was ready for it, but I was sure that war between Russia and Ukraine would be delayed somehow. And I was waiting for it maybe next year. And now I came to continue my work in America after the winter vacations in the middle of February, just, by the way, just after my visit to Kyiv. And then when I appeared here, a week later, the war began.
It's hard to explain to people who have never been there, but for the past decades, people who were in your milieu, writers, journalists, and then also business people and all kinds of people, lived a kind of double life, to say the least, in Moscow, which is to say, it was distinctly post-Soviet. Certain things existed that had never existed before. If I walked into a bookshop in Moscow or Petersburg or anywhere else, I could find books by Dmitry Bykov and many, many others that would never have been there in the certainly late Soviet period. There were restaurants and there was a social life and a commercial life that had exploded. But at the same time, Putinism existed. How, describe for us, for an American, what that deceptive kind of semi-authoritarian, semi-democratic culture was before the war in Ukraine.
Well, as for me, there was nothing, practically nothing. You know, the dictatorship wasn't evident in Russia. You couldn't feel it, for example. My books were not forbidden till March, and you could buy them. But as for the opposition, they were always feeling the pressure. For example, I was banned as a teacher, as a lecturer. I couldn't, for example, teach in official university, only in private schools. I had right to, had a license to read lectures, for example, for adults, not for children, but only in my private lectorium, the straight speech. I wasn't allowed as an official teacher. Then most of Russian oppositioners were always checked for their financial documents and for their non-extremism. You know that extremism is a typical verdict for Russian oppositioners. The restaurants are open, so the life is normal. Mm-hmm. You see, one of my friends said they go to restaurants because they have no other business. Everything except restaurants is forbidden. So maybe the dictatorship wasn't evident for foreign guests and for Russian Philistines who waste their time in restaurants. There is no journalism. There is no normal business, only business which is allowed by the state and so on. By the way, in one of Vasily Bykov's novels, The Sign of Drama or The Sign of Trauma, he wrote, "My only freedom is to smoke, because when I smoke, maybe that's the sign of free will." So for everybody who could see evident things, it was quite clear that dictatorship is not only near, dictatorship is here. And we understood it. You felt, being a poet, being a writer, being too sensitive maybe to be happy, you were feeling the horrifying pressure which was strengthening all the time. Sometimes you could feel, exceptionally being drunk, you could feel that this is your motherland, you're at home. But most of the time, I felt myself being at home in an American bookstore.
You felt most at home being in an American bookstore. Did you feel that way in the early 90s, in the first flush of the post-Soviet period? How long did it take before it became evident that any glimmer of a democratic possibility in Russia was over?
Well, you see, only Americans, only naive Americans could believe in democratic possibilities in the 90s. I lived there and I could see it. There were no democracy. There was a kind of new dictatorship, and so Yeltsin wasn't a democrat at all. He tried to be democrat, but he was a typical party leader who always creates extremal situations because he can act only in such situations, not in a peaceful world. As for me, I was quite sure even in the end of the 80s, and I was writing about it in my young and non-experienced journalism, in the end of the 80s, I was writing much that the destroying of the Soviet Union was an attempt to destroy a complicated system. You know, maybe the complication of system is the only measure of freedom. The Soviet Union was not as simple and straight as it is described, for example, abroad or in the novels of Russian dissidents. There were many types of people and many types of communities in Soviet Russia. So 90s were the decade of degradation, of the decay in all spheres of life, in culture, in science, in social sciences, and so on. There were some perspectives for the Soviet Union, like, for example, in a complicated chess party and chess game, but all the figures were thrown away from the board. And that's the reason.
All the pieces were swept off the board.
Yes, and that's the reason that the Soviet Union was not transformed. It was not transformed. It could be transformed, sure, but it wasn't.
What meaning does Putin therefore have? Was Putin a logical continuation of the Yeltsin you described from the 90s?
I must say that indeed Putin seems to be a real follower of Yeltsin, because Yeltsin's way of decision of solution of all problems was to shoot, like in Chechnya, for example, and in 1993. You know, Soviet Minister of Defense Paul Grachev said that we can take Grozny for 3 hours, and Russia was was killing its soldiers there for 10 years. They were sure that they'll take Kiev for 3 days. And now we understand that Ukraine appeared the giant swamp for Russian militaries, and maybe this war is for years. They can't take even Lysychansk. I think that Putin is just the final stage of Russian decline, because, you know, he is maybe the simplest, the most primitive figure in Russian power. He's so much smaller than the country, not only because he is small in general, but because his figure is comically and finally little.
Why do you say that? For years, much of the foreign press would talk about Putin as a master strategist, as far more experienced in the ways of power in the Machiavellian sense than anyone else on the world stage. You're describing him as a pipsqueak.
Well, not pipsqueak, but really primitive figure. Yeah, you see.
How do you mean?
It's very simple to be a strategist in Russia. You know, when the patience of people is endless and when you can do practically everything with them, including, for example, public executions. Maybe that's the limit of their power, yeah? You can do everything. And maybe this strategy is right. This strategy is not wrong because, you know, Vladimir Volodin, the speaker of Russian parliament, said there would be no Russia without Putin. Maybe he's right, because in Russia, Putin is the only and the last version of Russian Tsar. After him, there would be no legal governor of Russia. He's the last person who can unite the country somehow. You know, in Russia, they have just very clear choice to change their country, to change themselves, or to keep Putin. They prefer to keep Putin. So they're really ready to die, but not to change their mind.
I'm talking with Russian writer Dmitry Bykov. He's living in the U.S. and teaching at the Institute for European Studies at Cornell University. You seem to say it's impossible for anyone to imagine a Russia after Putin. Putin is a mortal figure. Can you imagine Russia politically after Putin?
Well, as for me, I can imagine, first of all, federal Russia, Russia with self-government, with regions which can govern themselves without directions of the center. But, you know, in Russia, most of people will oppose you. They will say, you call to the destroy of the system. You want to destroy the system. Most of them will run away from the center. I am sure that the only way to keep Russia as the whole, Russian as in Russia, as integrity, is to give all the rights to the government in places, for example, in cities, in republics, and so on, to make something like the United States of Russia. But in Russia, this idea is not popular because everybody believes only in centralization, only in central power and pyramid of power, in the so-called vertical. I'm sure that after Putin, we wouldn't keep the vertical system of power. But most of people are sure that in paternalist or maternalist state like Russia, nobody can be free. Because when you take decisions, like voting, for example, you are responsible for it. Most of Russian population wants to make Putin responsible for everything, to say after him, we didn't know, we couldn't prevent him. So this system of this runaway from responsibility is very comfortable for life.
Dmitry, you seem to hold the view that Americans mainly never permit themselves, which is to think of something as fixed and unchangeable. You seem to have the view that Russia is eternally doomed to some form of totalitarianism or authoritarianism, and to have a fate that will never see it free.
By the way, you know, it's not maybe a totalitarian power. It's some strange type of freedom. I'll explain. One of my students gave me the universal answer. I asked them in one of the groups teaching post-Soviet Russia. How can you describe the system where nobody believes in totalitarian ideas, where everybody are joking about it and laughing at it, but nevertheless they're obedient? Is it the country of slaves or the country of free people who are really free deep in their hearts? And one of my students said, in Russia, slavery and freedom are not mutually exclusive. That's quite right. Maybe we're the country of most free slaves, most obedient, and maybe sometimes most quiet, but deep in their heart, they never believe to the words they say. So it means that real, true fascism in Russia is not possible, because fascism is a type of intellectual discipline. But there is an imitative fascism. And most of the country is really serving Putin without any deep belief in his abilities or ideas. I'm quite sure that in Russia there are maybe 5% who really hate Ukrainians for their idea of freedom. And maybe 5% are liberals. And 90% are just waiting for any unseen future, any unpredictable future.
Dmitry, do you have family and friends in Ukraine?
Well, I have family only in the USA, and my ex-family, for example, my oldest son lives in Russia. That's a strange thing, really. But for example, if during the night I'll come as a guest to most of my Ukraine friends, they'll be happy to see me. I can't see it about my Russian friends. They wouldn't be happy. Not only because maybe they're Putinists. No, maybe sometimes they are my followers still. But, you know, in Russia, people are not happy when they see a night guest. They're afraid of him. Generally, maybe I have in Ukraine about 100 or 200 close friends, real intimate friends. And in Russia, maybe 10 people.
Really? Only 10 friends in Russia?
Only 10, yeah. You know, sometimes I feel a kind of nostalgia and I want to call something, just to call and to talk. But most of those people are dead, you know, I'm old enough. And some of them changed radically and I can't recognize them. And only 10 of them would be glad to hear me.
You know, you and I were emailing and I asked you, do you think that you have seen Russia for the last time?
Well, you know, it's a national sport in Russia to imagine that you see everything for the last time. When I left Russia half a year ago, I was quite sure that I'll be back, and even now I'm quite sure that I'll be back very soon. I'm sure that we'll meet the new year, as usual, at Echo of Moscow, which is banned now. At the same building at Novy Arbat, we'll celebrate the new year.
Whoa, wait. What you're saying is by the end of the year, not only will you be back in Moscow...
By the end of the year, because we'll have the radical change in August and the disappearance of Putin's regime in October. That's not only my prediction. I have a very professional predictor in Russia who agrees with me.
Who is that?
Just a girl from my class. And I have talks with my friends. Most of sensitive friends feel the nearing of catastrophe.
And the catastrophe would be what?
I can't say. Maybe it would be a typical Russian revolution, senseless, as Pushkin said, and cruel. Putin's ideas are not very popular among his surroundings. I can't imagine how it happens. I only see the direction. Maybe I give 10 or 15% for peaceful development of the situation. But, you know, every his step is worse, for example, than yesterday.
Dmitry Bykov, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Dmitry Bykov, novelist, poet, biographer, journalist, and broadcaster, and now a man without a country. He's currently teaching in the U.S. at the Institute for European Studies, based at Cornell University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Evan Pushak is known professionally as the Nerd Writer. His videos on YouTube have racked up millions of views, dissecting a wide variety of topics from Shakespeare and Tarkovsky to Martin Luther King.
I am happy to join with you today.
Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is arguably the most important and most well-known speech of the 20th century. It's 1,667 words and 17 minutes long, absolutely riddled with big, difficult terms.
But as the name he goes by suggests, the Nerd Writer goes very deep on pop culture as well. He'll talk, for example, about the debt that Bruno Mars owes to James Brown.
If you want to understand why, at weddings across America and the world this year, thousands, probably millions of people will be lunging their pinky fingers over their heads, you have to go back to 1967.
Our producer, Gofan Emputubwele, is an avid consumer of video essays, and he talked with Pushak about this new genre of nonfiction born on the internet. Here's Gofan.
On YouTube, you are the nerd writer. How did you end up here? And were you always sort of a very studious learner type?
No, I wasn't. In high school, I definitely wasn't. I was sort of a kind of class clown, and I'm still really goofy. But even back then, I was obsessed with things that I didn't connect to education. I was obsessed with Superman and comic books and things like that. But in college and after college, I became really frustrated with this feeling of not understanding what I believe and think about things. I think at some point in your life, you want to have a sense of who you are. The nerd writer and the book are ways of expressing an understanding and working out the things that I believe.
So I want to us to look at one of your video essays together.
Okay.
And actually, it's an essay. You write about the same topic, or you write about the same universe in your book, that universe being Lord of the Rings. And the video essay you have is about Gandalf. Gandalf, for those who don't know, is a magician, the better Dumbledore, among other accolades.
careful with that. You're gonna anger a lot of people.
I'm willing to die on that hill. The video essay is about Gandalf's eyes.
In The Lord of the Rings, Ian McKellen's eyes, in particular, carry a heavy load. Gandalf is the moral center of the story. He's also the one who understands the significance of events in the broadest sweep. This means that Gandalf has to broadcast a whole lot of story information to the audience.
The ring has awoken. It's heard its master's call.
Okay, I have so much to say about this.
Great.
Okay, so we're talking about the difference between the written essay and the video essay. And I don't think I could have done this in a written essay with anywhere near the same justice.
Describe an instance of Gandalf's eyes and his acting in Lord of the Rings that's really meaningful to you. Like, what is it that you feel in your body when you watch that part?
So the one that comes to mind is when he's sitting with Pippin in the upper levels of Minas Tirith at the end of the Battle of Pelennor Fields in the third movie, where it's all this war.
And I'm just going to translate. Gandalf is with another character. They're in a castle.
Yes.
The movie's over, almost over.
Okay. So he's sitting there with Pippin. A battle's raging outside these doors. And there's this moment of quiet and silence where Pippin is feeling despair about the chances. And he says, I can't believe it's the end. And Gandalf says, no, it's not going to be the end. Death, if death comes, is only another path, a path we all must take. And he describes what's sort of on the other side of this veil of death. And in describing it, what he does is move his eyes just ever so slightly over and up and into the distance, as if he's looking through the veil of death to the far green country that he's describing. And as a viewer, what I'm feeling is that I'm seeing this thing he's describing. When I'm just looking at his face, specifically, I'm just looking at his eyes, and I'm getting that emotion of, let me try to describe this. So in the book, I describe that I am not religious, I'm a non-believer, I don't believe there's life after death. But when Gandalf is describing this, these rolling hills and this far green country, this sort of vision of heaven, I sort of feel and believe it, that when you're inside a fantasy world, Ian McKellen, his eyes are bringing me to that place. They are immersing me in a story, showing me something I can't see on screen, and making me believe something that I don't actually really believe in the real world.
in the Gandalf video, it seems like you're trying to convey the same awe that you feel to us in as to us as viewers, like in the video essay. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I want to communicate, the experience I'm having. That I'm sort of obsessed with matching content with form. And so from the beginning of The Nerd Writer, I've been trying to figure out what is YouTube good at specifically? Like, what are its strengths and weakness? What sets it apart from TV or books or podcasts or whatever?
Yeah, so what is YouTube good at?
So I think YouTube is attracted to breaking things down. It's a lot of the classic Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. He was talking about movies, how movies in the theater, it's a very passive experience because you are sitting there in the dark and these giant images are washing over you. And it's high def, what are you doing? And you're just kind of passively engaging with it. Then that compared to that TV, you're sitting in your home, the lights are on, the windows are open, things are happening, you have the remote in your hand. It is a more active, engaged environment.
With Kobe up on him. The whole bag of tricks.
McLuhan said that TV was really good at showing processes, which is why you get something like instant replay in sports. Because we're just as interested in seeing the process of the play as the result of it.
Here's Kobe at the line after being fouled by Pippen and rattling it home.
So when you slow time to examine the catch from multiple angles, it's a way of participating in that image. And TV is a participatory medium. I think YouTube takes that even further and is even more obsessed with processes. And that's a function of the ways we interact with it. So you're sitting at the computer, holding your phone, you're scrubbing through the video, you're double tapping to rewind or changing the speed or whatever. Showing the process of something is really satisfying. The things I'm trying to describe or understand with my videos are the ways that those pieces of art or those pieces of information or ideas made me feel. Like I felt some kind of awe or some kind of arresting emotion about this. There's a famous Virginia Woolf quote. She was an extraordinary essayist, of course. And she said that an essay should lay us under a spell with its first word, and we should only wake refreshed with its last. And so that idea of putting you under a spell is part of my aim as someone who's making videos.
One of the things that as I've been reflecting like a bit on video essays, I think one of the things that draws me to them is that it feels like, I think that if you grow up on the internet, so millennials and younger, you are receiving videos all the time. You're receiving videos like constantly, like funny videos, all kinds of videos. And I think that there's something about the video essay and the video essayists that I follow where it feels like, I get sort of meditative reflection. Because I live on the internet, that's the place where I can get like a meditative thought.
Yeah. And I actually think what you're describing is, what do people come to the essay for? Period. Mm. Like the written essay.
Go there. Do it. Tell me. So,
the essay is not a treatise. It's not a term paper. It's not something systematically covering everything about a subject. It is an inquiry. It is thought articulated in one case in prose, in this case in audiovisual medium. You don't come to the essay to necessarily become an expert on something. You come to it because you want to see thought articulated. the cool thing about the video essay is that you are seeing these people's thoughts articulated with a whole new toolbox. And the ones who use the specific toolbox of the medium that they're working in are the ones that I am most interested in.
Evan Pushak, who's known on YouTube as the Nerd Writer, his new book is called Escape into Meaning, and he spoke with the Radio Hour's Gofan and Putabuele. This week, in a special digital issue, The New Yorker is exploring the changing contours of family. And there's a conversation with Laura Wasser, a divorce lawyer to the stars. Plus, a comic strip by Liana Fink illustrates some of the parenting advice that she never took. That's all in our special issue this week at newyorker.com/family issue. And there's more to come on the New Yorker Radio Hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Kel Fasana is one of my favorite people in general, but one of my favorite people to talk about music. And he's a man of broad taste, from hip-hop to country and well beyond. Recently, he wrote about the rising country star, Hayley Witters. So, Kay, you've got a few songs for us to listen to today. What's the theme?
The theme of this is country music. You know, one of my goals for the magazine is to get paid to do stuff I would do for free. And one of the things I do for free is listen to country radio. I wrote this piece about Hayley Witters, who's an emerging country singer who this summer is trying to get her first single onto country radio. It's a song called Everything She Ain't. And, you know, so she's got her people at her record label plugging it. And it's a lot of suspense for her. She's been building. She's critically acclaimed. She's a great singer and songwriter. But in country music, you haven't quite made it until the radio stations are playing your song.
What's her story?
She's from Iowa, from a tiny town in Iowa called Shoeyville, and moved to Nashville, convinced she was going to be the next country star. And, you know, 10 years later, she was starting to wonder if it was ever going to happen. Ironically, one of her breakthrough songs was about that. She sang, I'm 12 years into a 10-year town. And the idea is that, you know, she had already maybe missed her chance, but she made a great album, made another great album. And, you know, now people are paying attention. At least, you know, people like me are paying attention.
So let's hear Everything She Ain't.
She ain't a peach, you ought to be picking. She ain't the cup of tea, you ought to be sipping. She treats you like you're broke, like you need fixing. You ain't getting nothing back for all that you're giving. If you're good with who you kiss and say la vie, but I can show you what you're missing. Yeah, boy, I can be the whiskey in your soda.
Now, speaking as a guy, meaning you, whose first piece for this magazine was a profile of Jay-Z way back when, How does this fit into your musical universe?
Well, my musical universe has expanded over the years. I grew up as a punk rocker. And, you know, I think it was really in the 2000s when I was working at the New York Times as a music critic that I started to listen to a lot of country music and found that I loved especially what sometimes people called new country or commercial country or Nashville country.
Big hat.
Well, sometimes big hat, although at the time it was morphing into a ball cap kind of genre, right? Mm-hmm. These things change. And I love the idea that Nashville was this town full of brilliant musicians all competing to write the perfect song. And the top ones get on the radio and get lodged in your brain. I like the idea that writing a song could be a little bit like solving a crossword puzzle.
And how does this song solve the crossword puzzle?
Well, Everything She Ain't, part of what you're trying to do is you're trying to do something that reflects the culture of country music. That's part of the fun of it, and that's part of the sense of belonging, right? So when she says she can be the shotgun in your Tacoma, she's kind of making a winking allusion to the small town Iowa where she grew up,
right.
But also letting you know that she finds the whole thing kind of fun and funny as well.
And where does Haley Witters sit in Nashville?
So Haley Witters is a good example of someone who spent a bunch of years in town trying to figure out who she is, trying to figure out, oh, do I get all glammed up to be a country star in Nashville? And what she found, what seems to have worked for her, is to double down on her roots. You know, she's from this small town in Iowa, and she plays it up in a really kitschy way now. She sometimes wears bloomers that say corn star on the back. And so, you know, she wears prairie dresses, and she's really all about, in a fun way, trying to embrace this idea of being, you know, a woman from a small Midwestern town. She's also part of a movement, you know, it's been much remarked upon in the last few years that on country radio, you hear a lot more men than women.
Right.
And there's people working to change this. Nicole Galleon is a successful songwriter in Nashville who started a label, Songs and Daughters, which is the label that signed Haley Witters. So she was part of this effort. One of the people working to change this is Maren Morris, who's a great singer and songwriter in Nashville, and she's had great country success while also having some success outside of country music. She had a huge pop hit a few years ago called The Middle, and she has a new album. Maren Morris has a new album called Humble Quest, which is a really good record. It's a really smart record, and her current single, which is on country radio, is called Circles Around This Town.
Where I don't know how I trusted a Montero with the AC busted. A couple bad demos on a burn CD would take me all the way to Tennessee. I showed up to the new apartment. First month, last month, two deposits. Hadn't heard the sound of a door slam yet. Thank God I was an optimist. I drove circles around.
That is a really bottom-heavy sound. In other words, more bass than guitars or lap steel, whatever.
Yeah, it's got a beat, and then when the chorus hits, you hear that country music sound that maybe is something that you're more expecting to hear. One of the things I like about I love songs that do two things at once, and one of the things I love about Circles is that if you're not paying attention, it's just a great driving song, right? Mm-hmm. I'm driving circles around this town. If you are paying attention, it's a meta song. It's a song about what it's like to try and write a great song and what it's like to try and succeed in country music. And so in that way, it both fits in and sticks out on country radio.
Obviously, ultimately, the arbiter of what a great song is, and in the popular commercial sense, is the audience. But who are the arbiters in Nashville? Who decides? How does that work?
Oh, it's so complicated. You know, it's a little bit of an art, a little bit of a science, a little bit of a scam. Some combination of those.
How so?
Well, you know, there's a whole arm. These record companies have whole departments that are devoted, as has been true for, you know, half a century, to getting songs onto the radio, sometimes in straightforward way, flattery, sometimes probably some other ways as well. And then the radio stations.
Some other ways meaning payola.
Well,
does that still exist?
I don't know about straightforward payola, but certainly if you listen to the radio, they might have something called a flyaway, where there's a contest where you can win the chance to get flown to a concert by this artist and put up in a hotel, and you get to see them $500 spending money. And that contest will be sponsored by the record company behind the artist. Right. So yes, there's marketing campaigns, and certainly in that way, some money is changing hands, and the record company is spending some real money. At the same time, there is this science, or maybe pseudoscience, that the labels still do, where they do research. They survey people, they play them snippets of songs and say, do you like this? Do you like that? And they're really, you know, as they've been doing for decades, they're trying to figure out, if we play this song, are people going to change the dial, or are people going to keep listening? And the fact that country radio still exists as this industry devoted to giving people what they demonstrably want, which is sometimes different from what they say they want.
How do you mean?
Well, sometimes people would say, I would like to hear more of this on the radio. I would like to hear more of that. And then you do the research and you find out, well, apparently not. Apparently this is what you like. Apparently this is what keeps you listening. So it's interesting to me to see that all these stations are trying to give people what they want, and the artists are trying to give people what they want, maybe with a twist or maybe in a slightly different way. One of my favorite examples of this phenomenon right now is a song by Tim McGraw, who's been, you know, he's been around forever. He's been making country music for more than 30 years. He's been around so long that Taylor Swift's first single, more than almost 15 years ago, was called Tim McGraw and was a song about listening to Tim McGraw. So he's as established as it gets.
He's huge.
And he has a song on radio right now called 7500 OBO.
What does that mean?
It's about the least euphonious title you could imagine. I was going to say, can you guess what this song is about?
I cannot in a million years.
7500 OBO is what you'd put in the want ad if you're selling a truck. 7500 or best offer, OBO.
Got it.
And it's a song about a guy who's got a truck. It still works pretty well, but he wants to sell it because it reminds him of the woman he used to hang out with in that truck. It's got leather seats, a sunroof, it's sitting on 30 degrees, it runs smooth, it'll get you from A to B, but not for me. Cause every time I turn that key, I see her shotgun riding down a two-lane road, just driving around with no place to go. Singing along to where the green grass grows, hands out the window floating on the breeze. She's fixing her lips in the drop-down mirror, that pretty little thing made it hard to steer. I'm never gonna get her out of there, there's too many memories. Now there's a for sale sign. Now, my favorite thing about this song is that it is one of two songs currently on country radio with the exact same plot. Right now on country radio, you can listen to 7500 OBO by Tim McGraw, or you can listen to New Truck by Dylan Scott, which has the same plot. It's about having to sell a truck because it reminds him of the woman he used to be with. Radio works, it don't show dirt, worth every dime I spend. I was gonna drive it till the wheels fell off. Yeah, that was before she slammed the door, said it's over, then got lost. I need one, she ain't. I'd love to know what's going on behind the scenes in Nashville when these songwriters realize that they have this song, they think it's pretty good, and then they come to find out they're one of two people on the charts with the same theme.
This is kind of more orthodox country, got the pedal steel.
Well, it's funny. It's a good example of how orthodox can mean different things, right? Like the Tim McGraw song has, I believe, a drum machine, which is not traditionally how you would do the rhythm in a country
track. Not even by
now. Well, no, I mean, it's still a fairly new version of country music, but the fact that a song with a drum machine might sound orthodox tells you something about how the definition of country changes over the years, and how a great singer like Tim McGraw can not only make a drum machine sound orthodox, he can turn a phrase like 7500 OBO into a memorable chorus.
Thank God you explained this to me right away. Now, final pick, what do we have here?
So, a bunch of years back, I profiled George Strait for the magazine, who's a country institution, has more number one hits than just about anyone. And, you know, he was doing this show in Vegas at the arena there. And before he went on stage, he'd play a medley of contemporary country songs. And at first I thought, oh, that's interesting. He's playing a bunch of new country songs before he gets on stage. And then I realized what he was doing. He was playing a medley of songs that mentioned him. There are so many songs that mention George Strait that he could do a mixtape of nothing but George Strait songs in that sense.
That's great.
And this is a new addition to that canon. It's by Scotty McCreery, who's a kind of a lower-profile country hit maker. He won American Idol about a decade ago, and he's had a bunch of hits since then. And this is maybe my favorite, or one of them. It's called Damn Straight.
Nobody in his right mind would have left her. That was her favorite song. She sang along every time it came on. First time we danced was to Marina Del Rey, and I fell right there and then. I didn't want that song to end. Baby blue was the color of her eyes. I can still see them in my mind. Probably will for the rest of my life. Damn straight, you're killing me, man. You know I've always been your biggest fan. Now I can't.
And part of the fun of this is that if you know George Strait, he's name checking a lot of his song titles.
Right. And
you know, he's singing Nobody in His Right Mind Would Have Left Her. That was her favorite song. And so part of the fun is finding these old George Strait song titles. And then his idea is that he can no longer listen to George Strait because he misses his woman. And David, you're the editor of The New Yorker. You know something about literary tropes and techniques. So I think you probably have an idea of where this is going. He can't listen to George Strait anymore because he misses his woman. Does he wish he could get her back?
I think he might.
Damn straight.
Okay, thanks so much. It's great to see you as always.
Thanks, this was fun.
Damn straight, you're killing me, man. You know I've always been your biggest fan. Now I can't even listen, cause I'll get to missing her, then the hurt gets worse.
The New Yorker's Kella Fasani, with songs by Scotty McCreery, Maren Morris, Haley Witters, and Tim McGraw. You can read Kella at newyorker.com. writing about Haley Witters, along with Morgan Whalen, and many more. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and this week, we're saying our goodbyes to producer Alex Barron. In his years on the program, Alex worked on stories about the treatment of terrorist suspects, a Confederate monument in Maryland, quite a few humor pieces, and he has a particular interest in the culture of the internet, like the time he reported on the GameStop craze.
I am not an investment guy. I've never bought an individual share of stock in my life, but I found all of this really exciting. And so I spent $400 to buy a share of GameStop. Actually, 1.090222 shares.
Needless to say, he sold at a loss. Alex, keep making great stuff and stay away from the day trading. Best of luck to you always. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele, with help from David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Meng-Fei Chen. And we had original music this week by Alex Barron.
We had additional help this week from Michael May and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.